This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
We woke up to the news of another mass shooting in a country where mass shootings feel almost too commonplace. We cannot get used to this. Today's tragedy is this. At least 8 people are dead. Many more are injured after a gunman opened fire late last night at a FedEx facility. Now, this one happened in Indianapolis. Police say that it appears the killer also took his own life. So far, his motive remains a mystery.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that was Gail King on CBS reporting on that story. It is a tragic story. I'll bring you up to speed on all the latest details of that. We'll take a look at why this is happening. What can we do to prevent it? And it almost seems strange to me. You know, we see such a spike once again in these mass shootings. And again, there's been a strong move for gun legislation. And we'll talk about whether this will exacerbate that situation. We'll get into that much more. There was another shooting, too, of course, a tragic one that took place. And I'm sure you probably saw this. My heart goes out to the parents of Adam Toledo. And Chicago police have released video of another officer shooting. This kid was only 13 years old. And it is graphic footage of an officer shooting dead a 13-year-old boy in a dark alley. And thank God for body cameras. I think every officer, everyone in law enforcement should have them on. It protects them, but it also protects, you know, the civilian. The body camera video shows the policeman shouting, "Drop it, drop it," you know, before he opened fire on this kid. The boy had his hand behind a wall, right? And there is some other footage looking like he was tossing something. When he brought his hand back up, of course, the officer fired. The boy does not appear to be holding a weapon in the split second that he was shot. But like I said, police video shows a handgun near the spot where he falls. So small protests were held on Thursday evening around the Chicago area after, you know, this is hours after the mayor just appealed for calm. We saw what happened in Minnesota, too, right? I mean, we are seeing riots in these particular cities. So on top of the mass shooting in Chicago, we're seeing mayhem on the streets. Here is a look at what's now unfolding.
Dozens taking to the streets, one group marching from Millennium Park up Michigan Avenue to the Magnificent Mile. These groups were protesting police violence and calling for justice for Adam Toledo, another group making its way through the West Loop, both groups briefly blocking traffic. And then there was this protest right here outside Chicago Police Headquarters. Activists in Adam Toledo's home community of Little Village and beyond outraged by what they say the police body camera video shows.
He put his hands up and was still murdered. So I have a question. What more could he have done?
I want to say to the mama, I'm here with her in solidarity. We will fight all the way.
And it's a tough situation. I put myself in the shoes of the officer, not, you know, believing there's a gun, opening fire, and then realizing he shot a boy. But then I put myself in the shoes of the parent. And I thought, if that was my 13-year-old boy, how would I be reacting right now? So it is a difficult situation. Of course, the really big news, that's just another shooting, of course. Not to dismiss it or downplay, don't misinterpret what I'm saying here. It's one of a number that we're seeing in the country. The big news today is the shooting that took place overnight at the Indianapolis FedEx facility. There was another horrific mass shooting that we as a nation have to deal with. 8 families today. 8 families are grieving. They are grieving the deaths of their family members. And one more member of our society has taken his life, as many people before have taken theirs. This murder, suicide, I don't have an answer for what's driving this. Police haven't pieced together a motive. They haven't even released the names of the victims or the perpetrators. Apparently, there's a lot of evidence that they need to sift through at the scene. CBS This Morning will tell you more about this horrific shooting in Indianapolis.
They have an active shooter currently at FedEx.
The late night shooting unfolded at a FedEx facility near the Indianapolis International Airport. Police say when they arrived, they encountered the shooter who ultimately took his life.
We have located 8 people at the scene with injuries consistent to gunshot wounds. Those 8 were pronounced deceased here at the scene.
At least 4 other victims were hospitalized with gunshot wounds. Witnesses described a chaotic scene.
And I saw an assault rifle of some sort. I saw the clip, and he started firing.
Jeremiah Miller was outside the facility about to start his second shift when he heard the gunfire.
I hear 6 shots fired at once.
Multiple bullets even struck this car in the parking lot, blowing out its windows. After the shooting, facility workers were rushed into buses and taken to a nearby hotel to reunite with anxious loved ones.
Again, I sit back here as I hear these stories, and you never know when tragedy is going to strike. You never know the day or the hour, do you? You know, you go to work, and you may never, you know, talk to your loved ones again, or you may never see your loved one again. And this is just another major mass shooting in our country. And, you know, we've talked about the Mandalay Bay shooting. We've talked about, you know, Virginia Tech over the years. We've talked about what happened at Columbine. I mean, we can go through the whole litany of these things. There's so many of these stories. It's tragic. There's a group called the Gun Violence Archives. And what they do is they define a mass shooting as one where at least 4 people are killed or injured. Okay, that's how you define a mass shooting. There have to be 4 or more people killed or injured, including the shooter. So it could be 3 plus him. So by their definition, last night's shooting in Indianapolis is the 147th mass shooting this year. We're in April, right? We are in April. Does that make sense to you? I mean, those numbers, of course, are startling, but if you use that definition, still they're startling to me. 147 mass shootings this year, according to their definition. They say last year, guess how many? Take a shot at how many. We had COVID-19, right? People were locked down, businesses were closed, people were under curfew in some places. Guess how many mass shootings we had last year? They say that last year there were more than 600 of those kinds of shootings. Of course, the pandemic apparently blotted out the news coverage of a majority of those. But the Gun Violence Archives, as I said, the definition of mass shooting isn't, you know, that's not shared by everyone. They include shootings that took place in domestic settings, took place in the commission of crimes, you know, others who are tracking this, like the Washington Post and CNN. They don't include those kinds of shootings in their definition. So I'm just giving you that number based on how they're defining it right now. But, you know, when I think of a mass shooting, I think of something a little bit different. But no matter how you analyze it, the fact is that we are having a lot of these types of shootings. And obviously it indicates that something is seriously wrong with our society. I want to look at that today. What's behind all this? When a kid goes on a shooting spree because he wants to eliminate a source of temptation. Remember that story? This guy went into that massage parlor and killed all those people because, you know, all those women because they were a source of temptation. Or when some other guy randomly walks into a grocery store and starts shooting people at random. You know, we either have a mental health crisis in this country or there's something spiritual going on or there's something else at play. So let's talk about this, okay? I've invited today Barry Latzer. He's a renowned criminologist. He's the author of the book, The Rise and the Fall of Violent Crime in America, and a professor emeritus at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He joins us today for his for perspective. We'll take your calls, too, so feel free to join us. Professor, always a delight to talk to you. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Drew. It's great to be with you again.
This is always such a tough issue for me. I dislike very much talking about these mass shootings. I feel like I'm doing it way too frequently. You know, we talked about the definition. You know, according to the Gun Violence Archives, there were 600 of these shootings last year. Maybe their numbers are inflated. What do you think of the definition, the way they define a mass shooting? And here's the question, you know, in terms of the 600 last year, we've had 147 this year, and that's probably shocking to people. Are we hearing about these, or why don't we hear more about them now? So maybe you can give me some perspective on how we are, we're viewing these things and how we come up to these numbers.
I think the Gun Violence Archive is using a pretty standard definition. The criminologists used a similar definition. Four people dying in one incident seems like the standard and acceptable definition. And I was just checking the same data that you were referring to a moment ago. And yes, 2020 had a new high for since 2014, 610 of these incidents. So, you know, it spikes some years, it goes down other years, but it's still way too high. Even the low was 269 wow. of these incidents.
That's amazing.
And that was 2014.
Yeah, I don't know if you can answer the question, but I'd love your analysis or perspective on it. I mean, 600 last year was a shock to me because businesses were closed, bars and restaurants were not open. There were no venues where sporting activities were taking place. All these places where people gather, where you could see things maybe get out of control. We are in the first quarter of this year at 147 already. Last year's a surprising figure for me, 600 of them. What do you think caused 600 mass shootings last year?
Isn't that something? I mean, you know, Drew, I have a new book just out, by the way. It's called The Roots of Violent Crime in America. And in doing that book, I went back to the great pandemic of 1918, the so-called Spanish flu. I wanted to see if that reduced a crime during that period. And it didn't. The states that had high incidence of that Spanish flu, as they called it, also had high incidence of murders. So obviously, even the pandemic, even coronavirus doesn't seem to reduce. And in fact, as you said correctly, we have more incidents in 2020 than we had in the prior years. So that's a bit of a surprise, I think. You'd feel that with fewer people out on the streets, et cetera, there would be fewer incidents. So what I think is happening here is, first of all, we're talking about long guns, even semi-automatic guns in some cases. And I think we're talking about people with some serious mental illness.
Yeah.
And the final fact is, you get these copycat incidents. People who are mentally unstable to start with see the news about these other shootings and they just go over the line and engage in that kind of violence themselves. And that's why I think we get them in a cluster, you know. It seems like you get one after the other this way, and it's very disturbing.
Explain that to me. I never understood that. What's with the copycat mentality? As a criminologist, I mean, what would motivate somebody because they saw somebody at the Mandalay Bay or wherever on the news do this? Is it a desire for fame? Is it mental? It's got to be a mental disorder. But what? Explain the whole copycat situation.
Yeah, I think so. I think these are people who are probably psychotic, but certainly seriously mentally disturbed. They have access to guns, long guns, often semi-automatic guns, and seeing others engage in this kind of violence and get all this attention seems to encourage them to do the same thing. And for many of them, it also may be suicide by cop. We hear that the Indianapolis shooter killed himself. Maybe so. In other incidents, the police shoot them and they really can foresee that they're not going to walk away from this incident, and they do it anyway. So these are people, I think, who have serious mental illness and yet have access to guns. But, you know, even if we could predict, Drew, every person with mental illness who was going to turn violent, even if we could, how are you going to prevent them from borrowing a gun or getting a gun in some other way, by theft perhaps, getting it from a friend, collecting them? I mean, I just don't see the way out of this. I just don't see it.
Yeah. I don't either. I mean, it's a very frustrating situation. It's a very difficult one. Jake was just talking in my headset. He says they've identified the shooter. Jake, can you open your microphone and share with everyone what you were just telling me?
Not much is known at this point, Drew, other than the fact that the police chief and the AP is now reporting that they have identified who the suspect is. As far as I know, I don't think they've released the name or anything like that, but that's what's currently being reported.
All right, thanks, Jake. Stay on it for me. Let's go to the phones, Doctor. We'll take a few phone calls. Rita, you are on the air with noted criminologist and professor Barry Latzer. Good afternoon.
Yes, I'm calling about the the young 13-year-old boy who was gunned down. I'm very concerned about this. We've been having so many of these teenagers getting killed. But where are the parents? This boy was out in the middle of the night with a 21-year-old gang member who was probably trying to show him the ropes of how to do things. And where are the parents? In the middle of the night, they should be checking on their teenagers, making sure that they're in bed.
Rita, you know what? Let me just say, you bring up a great point. No, you bring up a wonderful point. And Barry, let's talk about that for a moment, because she's right. You know, here's a 13-year-old out in the middle of the night. You know, there's some footage that indicates there was probably a weapon. He ends up dead. It's a tragedy. Those poor parents are going to mourn. We talk about mental health issues. In the city of Baltimore, and you and I may have spoken about this before, the rate of fatherlessness there was through the roof. And a year or two ago, when riots were taking place and things along those lines, that stat came up. What is the role of the abdication of parents? What does that play in what we are currently seeing in terms of some of this gun violence and some of the tragedies that we're now seeing? Because, you know, the other thing, and I mentioned this before, and this is no way to be insensitive, but, you know, I made this comment to somebody. Look, when the police give you an order or command, comply. And I told my own kids, if you get pulled over, yes, sir, no, sir, here's the registration, here's the insurance, here's a license, hands 10 and 2, and just whatever they ask, you do. You watch most of these situations. There was that shooting in Minnesota earlier in the week. You have this shooting. When you do not comply, it tends not to turn out well. And I'm not making an excuse for any police officer who's abused his authority or acted inappropriately, but it often turns into a fight. There was a guy in North Carolina, I think it was the Carolinas, who was going to be arrested for DUI. You remember that? Protest followed that after he fought the officers, literally, who was fighting them as they tried to make the arrest. None of these situations would have taken place if they simply complied. So a couple things, and I don't want to be insensitive, but what is the role of parents teaching their kids to respect order and authority? I think we've lost that in the culture. And then secondarily, to Rita's point, yeah, this kid's out in the middle of the night. Where the heck are their parents, and why is their kid out in the middle of the night? But go ahead, to your point. I'll let you respond.
No, I think it's a good point, too. I think Rita has a very good point. Of course, it's very hard to manage kids, and boys especially, I guess, have a little more leeway in going out at night and also engage in more violence with gang activity. So, yeah, this is a significant problem. And by the way, from the police standpoint, if you look at the law of self-defense, what it says is that if the one who ultimately killed the victim believed reasonably that a potential shooter was armed or dangerous, then the shooting is justified. So what counts is whether the officer had a reasonable belief. At least that's what the law says. Of course, people are very upset, and I don't blame them. And it's a terrible thing that we've lost a young lad's life here.
You know, it's tragic. It really is. As I said, my heart goes out to the parents. I mean, if I was the parents of this child, oh my gosh, I'd be devastated over this. And of course, this officer now has to live with this as well. So nobody wins in this situation. If you want to join us, I'm going to open the phones. You can get in 888-914-9149. I'm joined by renowned criminologist and author Barry Latzer. Before I go back to the phones, I do want to talk about the gun control issue, because on Capitol Hill, there's a strong move to enact stricter gun control legislation in the country. And it's a major issue of our time. It's a major issue of this administration. And obviously, people would argue you're not going to have these shootings if you did not have those guns. Although the data does prove that most people who commit these crimes, they've gotten their guns illegally. Although many of these have been done in those legal situations. But we have a Second Amendment. And we also have 300 million guns in circulation in the country. So will gun control laws do anything to stop this? And I'd love your take on the problem, this challenge that we face. It seems like a conundrum.
Well, you have different gun problems, don't you, Drew? I mean, Look at the city gun violence. Those are handguns, sometimes stolen, sometimes brought in legally, and they're accessible by gangs. So you have these young male gangs with a lot of access to handguns, legal or illegal. I don't see how the gun control laws are going to do anything about this. New York City has some of the strictest gun control laws in the country, and yet you have this big spike now in shooting incidents with handguns and often by gangs. Yep. So I don't see the laws doing anything about that side of the gun problem. The other side, of course, is these people with these mental infirmities who have access to guns, long guns, and even if you prevent them from buying them, and they should prevent them from buying them. I can't see any justification for people with mental problems being able to purchase a gun, but they'll borrow it or they'll take it from a friend. The shooter up in Connecticut, the fellow who shot all those children in that school, he took the gun from his mother's collection.
Let's go back to the phones. Danielle is listening in Northern Maine. Hi, Danielle. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is a subject. We just had a shooting just 2 days ago in like 15 minutes away, Marcel, Maine. Three guys, the officer shot him. He had a knife to his girlfriend's throat and like he didn't have a gun. So we've had three officers. And so, and my son, it's like his mental illnesses is when he was a minor, so it's not registering. He had three guns, suicidal, and the officers wouldn't even take the guns from him.
Wow, that's
tragic. But that wasn't what I was calling. I was calling about these video games. Mm-hmm. And like Adam Lanza, like the man that's with you there today, officer. Not sure what not. He was saying about Adam Lanza, he had took the guns from his mom. Like his mom taught him how to go and like, he was also playing these video games. I mean, one's like school shooting. And so they're learning how to reload. And so when does virtual and reality, come together?
Danielle, thanks. I'll tell you, let me hold you right there because I got to take a break. When we come back, we'll address the issue of gun violence and in particular what we're seeing manifested now in some of these video games on the big screen and in other venues as well. And we'll take a few more calls too. The number here, 888-914-9149. Speaking today with the author of the book, brand new, hot off the presses, The Roots of Violent Crime in America, criminologist Barry Latzer. We're back with more right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The truth.
Thanks, Drew. Always a quest for the truth.
Now.
And it just reinforced why I love Relevant Radio, because you guys got the truth.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, thank you for joining me. It is good to be here with you. We'll pray the chaplet coming up in about a half an hour. Let's certainly pray for what we're seeing unfold in our country today. A parent has lost a 13-year-old child in a Chicago police shooting. That police officer now has to deal with the fallout from that, and the unrest in the country continues. I was just during the break looking at a report that showed me that in the U.S. has reported at least 45 mass shootings in just the last month, in just the last 30 days. And when eight people died in a mass shooting at a FedEx facility in Indianapolis on Thursday night, the news was compounded by just a string of similar incidences that preceded it. And when you go back, you know, I was sharing with you the eight people that were killed, at those three Atlanta area spas by that young man who wanted to, disengage from the temptation. We've had 45 mass shootings, according to CNN reporting that analysis. And look, the numbers continue to rise. I was sharing before, if you're just joining me, that the U.S. has seen 147 mass shootings in 2021 alone. We're just in the first quarter of the year here, and they have taken place all across the country. So I've invited today to give us some perspective. Of course, we will take your calls, and it's always good to have you here with us. We appreciate your calls. You can join me at 888-914-9149. I'm joined by Barry Latzer. He's a renowned criminologist and the author of a couple books. His previous book was The Rise and the Fall of Violent Crime in America. And he just came out with a new one called The Roots of Violent Crime in America. He goes back to the early part of the 20th century, the 19th century. He was looking at the last great pandemic that took place in 1918, and violence was just as rampant there. And Barry, I want to go back to the phones, but I want to pick up on that point. How far back did you go looking at this type of violence? And is there any case to be made that if we had less guns, there would be less violence?
Well, I went back through to the 19th century, and there were lots of guns in the 1890s, a tremendous number of handguns, and yet there was relatively little violence. And there even was a big depression in the 1890s as well. So that really piqued my interest, because I wasn't expecting that when you have these terrible economic conditions and plenty of guns available, and yet you had relatively low violent crime. So that threw a bit of a curveball into the usual predictions. But by the 1920s, you might be interested to know this, by the 1920s, we were already seeing huge number of murders with firearms in this country. And I'm talking about around 70%, which is about where it is now. So, I mean, I don't see us getting a grip on this problem anytime soon. I think, I don't know what the country will have to go through before we can finally get control over the criminal use of these handguns.
All right, let's grab a call or two. A lot of people want to jump into the conversation. I'm grateful for your patience. Sonia, who is listening in Chicago, thank you for joining us. Good afternoon.
Hi, Drew.
Hey, Sonia.
My comment relates to the discrepancies in the media, local media versus national media. Mm-hmm. I have been following this story because I have three boys myself. I live in Chicago, too, and very concerned about the violence in the city. And when this first came out, one of our local newspapers called One Block Chicago reported that the mother had said to them that she had reported her son missing a couple of days prior to the shooting. But when you hear today's CNN story where her lawyer testifies to CNN that the mother put her son to sleep that night, the night of the shooting.
Uh-huh.
So I just concerned that, you know, the national media has a separate spin on the facts, and we're not letting things come out the way it should with a, you know, a very thoughtful investigation.
Yeah, that's great. Sonia, I'm glad you called and shared that with us. You're in Chicago there. Are your sons teenagers, or are they a little bit older now?
The oldest is 8.
I
did have a horrible experience last summer when we were going for a walk around the block, and we heard a drive-by shooting. So after that, I really decided to keep them home in the backyard most of the time.
Well, I'll say a prayer for your family's safety when we pray the chaplet, and I'm grateful for your call. I'm going to ask Barry Latzer now, your perspective on the reporting that we're getting out of the media as well. You know, I have to be careful about how I say this, but, you know, it seems often when certain legislation is put forth, we're hearing all this reporting on mass shootings. 600 of them last year really weren't reported on. I didn't hear many of those. 147 this quarter. Where is the media in terms of the way that they report this, and is there any sort of agenda, as you might see it, as Sonia would say, she's hearing different reporting locally versus nationally?
Well, the mass shootings get the most media, and in some ways it's misleading because many, many more people die through just what you might call ordinary street crime For instance, in 2018, when the Parkland and the Pittsburgh synagogue shootings took place, over 14,600 people died in non-mass shootings with guns, of course. So, I mean, horrible as the mass shootings are, disturbing, especially when they come in clusters this way, as they are, you still have many more people, if you count the deaths, you have many more people succumbing to what we might call ordinary street crime, non-mass violence.
All right. Well, let's move along. Kathy is listening in St. Cloud. Thank you, by the way, for your call, Sonia. Kathy, good afternoon. Kathy, I hate to do this to you, but, you know, you're fading out on us, so I am You try it one more time. If not, I think I got your point, and I will share it with everybody.
Okay. I believe that the media fantasizes a little bit on some of these shootings by just playing part of the clip, and they don't play the whole thing that took place.
Right.
And I think it really puts our officers in a bad spot because we have officers that are leaving all the time. And there's a lot of times where even officers lose their life in a line of duty, and we don't even hear about that on the news.
Well, Kathy, thank you. I made that out, and that's a very valid point. And she's in Minnesota, Barry, so it's an area that has been plagued with this type of thing. And she often says, we don't hear about the heroic officers who lose their lives. I mean, any loss of life is a tragedy. It really is. And she's right about some of the media.
Now, we have a serious problem with the policing. I mean, the police have to have the benefit of some doubt, too, because, after all, if there's gun violence, they have to go toward it. You and I can walk away. They can't walk away. Right. They have to address it, and they have to address it firsthand. And they are well aware that either they or the shooter may not come home to dinner that night. And they don't want it to be them. So they're in a very, very difficult situation. And the loss of confidence in our police, the feeling that the police are always wrong, the belief that they have to always be right, they can't have no margin for error, that's going to be a problem for recruitment, for morale, for proactive policing. It's going to be a problem for us in this country.
So if you're just joining me, I'm speaking today with Professor Emeritus at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, Barry Latzer. He's a renowned criminologist, the author of a couple books. I'll get you plugged into those. Feel free to join us. We're taking a look at not only the shooting in Chicago that's unfolded, what has happened in the Twin Cities, of course, what has happened in Indianapolis. This is all, literally, if you think about it, within days. What's the cause of this? What do the numbers reveal? How do we remedy this? Ron in Sherrillville, Indiana, has an insight he wants to share with you. Professor, hi, Ron.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to comment about comment that I heard the other day, the fear factor. Minorities get stopped by the police, and they're afraid that something is going to seriously happen because of the police supposedly not being able to control themselves. And the police are fearful of the minorities because they settle things with a weapon oftentimes. Yeah. So it's like a two-edged sword. I don't know if Dr. Lester has done any research on that or not, but there is definitely a fear factor on both sides.
Ron, I'm really glad you called. That's a great point. Doctor, does one feed the other? Fear of the police, you know, result in fighting or fleeing? And as a result of that, do the police, you know, do we see higher levels of these incidences because of that?
I think it's true. I think the caller is exactly right. I think there is fear on both sides. I can't document this. I don't have proof of this. A colleague of mine who was a police officer said, well, you don't really know. You can't say for sure that the police are afraid. I really think there's something like that going on. And I think the black, often in the black community, black youth are fearful of the police. So I do think the caller is right on the money.
All right, I do too, Ron. Great point. Actually, I had a conversation with my brother-in-law the other day about that. And I said, that's why these video cameras are so important in revealing the truth. It protects the officer, protects the individual as well. Because there was probably a time where somebody had a shooting, they could plant a gun or plant drugs or do something else there. I mean, fear foments a lot of this. So I think transparency is so important. Body cams. And I think one of the things the police should do, they talk about defunding or reimagining the police. I think we should work on, the police community relations. I think it's important, not defunding police. But Mariana is listening in Chicago. Yes. Mariana, welcome.
Yes. Hi.
No, I'm
sorry. I just want to make a quick comment my father has taught me how to handle handguns, and I may never own a handgun in my lifetime, but I don't believe that we should have the rights taken away and convene a constitutional Congress to start amending our constitutional rights.
Right.
So, and that's where I feel like some of the leftists and media is going to that agenda.
That's another great talking point for the conversation here, Mariana. Thanks. We haven't talked about the Second Amendment. And there is a move, by the current administration. They would like to see greater gun legislation. And your thoughts on the Second Amendment? You know, we needed a well-regulated militia, and the citizenry has a right to gun ownership. There's 300 million guns in the country right now. Some argue that Second Amendment is antiquated. You know, the citizenry, a militia, could never stand up against the current government if the government wanted to oppress them. Your thoughts on the Second Amendment and some of the moves now against it?
Well, the research I've seen actually shows that the founders who wrote the Second Amendment favored an individual right to bear arms, and it wasn't, although it's tied to the militia in the language of the amendment, it's not an essential. In other words, there's still an individual right. Now, is this an anachronism in the contemporary world? Probably so. Are we going to get rid of the Second Amendment or amend the Second Amendment? Not while I'm alive, that's not going to happen. Maybe the caller is much younger than I am. Maybe she'll see something like that. I don't believe there'd be any support for any amendment like that.
Yeah, I don't think we'll see that. Not in this country, that's for sure. Mariana, thank you for bringing that to the table here. John's got a question for you as a criminologist. He's listening in San Jose, California. Hi, John.
Hi, Drew and guests. How are you?
We're well, thank you. Thanks for calling.
I just have a question about the shooting that happened in South Carolina with the ex-NFL player. Does your guest maybe think that that was a gun issue, a mental health issue, or maybe even a racial issue? Mm-hmm. A beautiful family with two young children were just murdered.
Yeah.
So it really bothers me that that happened.
Yeah, I'm with you.
What are the details of that one? There's so many, I think I may have missed it or lost, or don't remember about it.
Yeah, it's not being brought up in the media anymore for some reason. It was an ex-NFL player who just shot a doctor and his family, and then there were two workers working at their home at that time. It's in South Carolina.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, I don't really know enough about the case to comment.
Well, that's why I'm calling. It just seems that the media can pick and choose what stories it covers, and there's no mention of this. And I just wanted to give justice to this family somehow because it's so horrible. But I appreciate your time, and thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for your call. I do appreciate it. Some final thoughts here. I know the phones are stacked right now. That issue in South Carolina is a tragic one, like so many of these others. That took place in Rock Hill. There was a former NFL player who killed six people, including a very prominent doctor, his wife, and their two young grandchildren before he killed himself. And I don't know whether it's, CTE, it's mental health, you don't know what foments this, but, as I was saying, doctors I was getting ready, or professors I was getting ready for this particular show, I was just looking at the litany of places in which shootings have taken place from Florida to California. It's pretty amazing. I'd love some final thoughts from you as I've got to take another break here and change gears, but leave us with a pearl of wisdom if you could.
Well, there's no question we have a gun violence problem in the country. I don't see us coming out of it anytime soon. I think we do need to focus in the big cities on the people who do crimes with guns, and we need to give them the appropriate punishment. But I just don't see a solution in the short term. Of course, I don't favor selling guns to people with mental health problems. Gun training might be helpful as well. Yeah. But I just don't see a solution to this, Drew.
Doctor, your books, Barry, how do they get them? What's the best way to get them, Professor?
The easiest way, of course, is at Amazon or other booksellers. Both are available. The newest book is in hardcover. It'll be out in paperback at a much lower price by the fall, I believe. And so I'm glad to be able to discuss these matters with you, Drew.
Well,
it's always a
pleasure. We'll have you back again. That's Professor Barry Latzer. He wrote The Rise and Fall of Violent Crime in America. His latest is The Roots of Violent Crime in America. My take on this is that there's more than just shootings. You know, we're a nation that has separated itself from God, and godlessness, it only leads to bad things. And the best way to prevent these kinds of things from happening is if we have a mass conversion in this country. So converting from sin and making our way towards God, that's the answer. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Get connected. Get a 360-degree look at all the news and issues of the day right now. This is the Drew Mariani Show. Getting you connected on Relevant Radio.
Well, some scientists are apparently trying to find that fountain of youth, but not the way that Ponce de Leon looked for it. Mm-mm, wait till you hear this story. Scientists believe they found it in the blood of young people. Now, this sounds like this conversation should be on about 3 a.m. But this is a true story. This was reported in Newsweek. Long article. I forget how many words it was. I was going over it earlier today. Plus, it's been reported on some scientific papers published back in 2011 and 2014. The blood from young mice seems to miraculously have restorative powers, restorative effects against the brains of elderly mice. And the findings, it goes against the established belief that the primary factor in getting disease as we age, you know, in itself, there's nothing you can do with it because that's the process of aging. So now researchers, they're looking for the blood of the young to siphon the enzymes or their molecules or whatever it is that they have, that those who are getting older won't have to succumb to the perils of aging. And according to Newsweek, there are already drugs in the pipeline based on those findings, and they're waiting for FDA approval. That could mean somebody selling these drugs maybe on the sly. But the Newsweek article reported that others worry that what might happen to these things. You know, will they deliver their promise? Will poor young people be coerced into selling their blood to elderly billionaires? Who knows? I mean, it's a crazy story, and here to help us understand it and unpack it is none other than Wesley Smith. He is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, and he is the author of 14 books, including his latest, Culture of Death, The Age of Do-Harm Medicine. And I hope you'll follow him at his Twitter handle, at the Wesley J. Smith. Good to have you with me, Wesley. Thank you for your patience today.
Hey, Drew. Good to talk to you again.
So this seems bizarre. I mean, and I even said to my show team this morning when I was working on this, the rundown for the day, I said, this can't be true. And we saw the sources, and it is true. Fill us in on what's being reported and what they hope ultimately one day to achieve.
Well, you kind of accurately summarized it in the introduction, but didn't we just have the same conversation about embryonic stem cells?
Yeah, we did, yeah.
I mean, every once in a while, these kinds of stories come out. Oh, here's the newest way to defeat aging. Here's the newest way to keep people from getting sick. I've come to distrust stories like this, and that comes from back in the days of the embryonic stem cell debate during George Bush's administration. And you'd see story after story, oh, the breakthroughs are here. It's just the FDA is almost ready to approve. And these stories sometimes are planted in order to get investors all excited to donate some money for research. Right. I don't know, obviously, whether this is true. And I have heard of these experiments, as you pointed out, for years. But I think there's a much more important issue to consider whether or not this is actually doable. And as you'll recall, that the Newsweek piece basically ends and says, really, the only way right now to delay the effects of aging is to exercise, keep your weight down, don't smoke, you know, the things we already know. But I think that this kind of that they put such a long story out there. That was one of the longest magazine stories I've ever read. Yeah. And I think it reflects a lot of fear. And you were talking before the break about, you know, returning to God. Well, if a society is becoming highly secularized, as we know this one is, then there's a certain consequence to that, and that is the destruction or the loss of hope. And so what you see trying to kind of fill that void where God used to be is something called transhumanism, and this is part of the transhumanist endeavor. That is to create a post-human species and most recently, transhumanists have been trying to sell the idea that we can have human immortality and eternal life, but here in the material world, not in the hereafter. And I just think it's a real sign that there's a deep nihilism and a deep fear in society that would say, you know, well, rather than respect the elderly, we're going to defeat age. Yep. Even assuming we could, Drew, what would the impact of that be on having new children? Yep. I mean, would we want us to be in a society where John Adams and George Washington were still alive? Because they would have, the fact that they left us allows a dynamism in society and allows a dynamism within humanity that would end if we all lived for 500 or 1,000 years. Society would become sclerotic. It would become moribund. And I think we should think very carefully about this, and particularly with regard to the spending of money. There are a lot of diseases that really need some research monies. And for my belief is the idea that aging should be treated as something unnatural is going off the rails.
No, I agree. I mean, we have a lack of respect
for
the elderly.
And I'm a guy who's getting up there, you know.
Yeah, it goes back to, I think, the lack of respect for human dignity at every stage.
Yeah.
You know, we've lost it for the elderly. We certainly don't have it for the child in the womb. Now, I was reading a story about monkey embryos that are being injected with DNA from human embryos and allowed to multiply.
Stem cells, not DNA, stem cells.
Oh, really? So what's happening?
Stem cells.
What's happening there?
So scientists have, and this should send out the alarm, scientists in China conducted an experiment, but they were not necessarily, some of them were American scientists. You know, we go over to China, my friend William Hurlbut, who's a Stanford bioethicist, calls it outsourcing ethics. So they'll go to China to do things they might not want to do here or might not get government approval in terms of funding here. So what they did is they created some monkey embryos, you know, through the IVF process, and then injected them with pluripotent stem cells from human beings. Pluripotent stem cells generally in this situation probably came from embryos, human embryos, and they can become any tissue in the body. And they followed these hybrid embryos, chimera embryos. They kept them going for 19 days, it's called differentiation. As the embryos began to create different types of cells, whether it's kidney cells or bone cells, they are also probably creating neural cells, brain cells. And so you've really crossed the line here when it's one thing perhaps to do those kinds of experiments on mice, but it's another to do one that on a monkey that has a much closer genetic affinity to human beings. And I think this is really getting to the place where you went, if they kept it going, obviously they destroyed the embryos. But if you kept it going until you had a birth of an animal like that, would that animal be human? Would that animal be animal? How would we determine its moral value? What kind of cruelty would it be if, let's say, that it had a certain awareness and it was the only one around? I mean, these are experiments that really take us to the edge, in my view, of ethics. But also they demonstrate that this idea that scientists keep pitching for us in biotech, which, by the way, is the most powerful technology since the splitting of the atom. I mean, you've already had genetic engineering of human beings, again in China, by the way. And they say, well, we're going to have voluntary guidelines to govern this, the ethics of this. Well, voluntary guidelines are worth the paper they're written on. What we really need are mandatory, first we need a moratorium on this research. All of this stuff using human beings and human tissues and cells and so forth, so that we can have the time to have the conversation about what we want and what we don't want. You don't want to be a Luddite and say no research of any kind, but you also don't want to unleash Brave New World. This will take some effort and some time to get through in terms of determining, as you said, whether or not we are in danger of threatening human dignity. Yeah. But unless we have some kind of enforceable moratorium, we'll never have the time to do that, because scientists are just going to keep going forward as they see fit.
Oh. So, Wesley, I wish we had more time to talk. I really do. I'm grateful for your patience today. I want to make sure everyone can follow you on Twitter. It's at The Wesley J. Smith, okay? At The Wesley J. Smith. The Wesley J. Smith. Please follow him there. Also, check out his book, Culture of Death, The Age of Do Harm Medicine. We'll pray the chaplet when I return.